Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together to address problems instead of defending positions. About a month ago, I heard some really good news, and then I got really upset. A chiropractor friend told me that a colleague of his had successfully treated more than 30 COVID-19 cases, including an 80-year-old man who had been sent home to die by the hospital using alternative means. However, his colleague could tell no one what he had done, lest he lose his license. Meanwhile, treatments as innocuous as intravenous vitamin C therapy have been removed by Facebook by orders of the World Health Organization. If you listen to my April 1st interview with vitamin C expert Andrew Saul, you can hear more about that. Now, as you hear of the COVID-19 casualties likely caused by the lame and incoherent response of our narcissist in chief, I'm left to wonder about something else. How many COVID patients would be alive today or would have had much milder cases had they had access to the full panoply of healing modalities, including prevention? Certainly, the public needs to be protected against false or misleading information. But what if the protectors have another agenda? Those of us who believe in science are told to follow the guidelines of medical authorities, but consider this quote by the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Marcia Angel. Quote, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reach slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine." She is writing, of course, about the influence of big pharma on the entire medical industry and conversation. On today's show, we're going to be talking with an outspoken critic of Dr. Anthony Fauci of the Center for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. He's an advocate of alternative therapies and medical choice. Dr. Rashid Buttar graduated from Washington University with a double major in biology and theology, went on to attend medical school at the University of Osteopathic Medicine and Health Sciences. He trained in general surgery and emergency medicine, served as a brigade surgeon and director of emergency medicine while serving in the U.S. Army. He is board certified in clinical medical toxicology, preventive medicine. He serves as a medical director for the Centers for Advanced Medicine, and serving patients with immune dysfunctions and toxicity issues. He's past president of the North Carolina Integrative Medical Society. He's been chairman of the American Board of Clinical Metal Toxicology for 8 years. His first book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, became a Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Amazon bestseller, and is now an international best-selling book translated into multiple languages. Welcome, Dr. Buttar. It's great to have you.
Nice to be here.
Great. Now, you've gone out on a limb in questioning the mainstream medical narrative on COVID-19 and the protocols to best deal with it. I want to know how come and what understandings do you have that have put you at odds with what the media has been telling us, and why haven't more doctors spoken out the way you have?
Well, first of all, I have never said anything about any protocols being used for COVID-19. We have our own belief system and philosophy in how we treat patients, and my issue has never been with what protocols are being done, because I'm not really familiar with what protocols are being used for COVID-19. I can only tell you what is being done in the ICUs and such, and that is not any protocol-driven medicine. That is just inappropriate care, where people are being put on external pacers when they shouldn't be, and when they're being intubated when they shouldn't be. They're basically mistreating a person, whether it's COVID or anything else. It's mistreatment. So that's that has nothing to do with protocols. And if somebody doesn't know what they're seeing and they're not addressing what they're actually seeing, and it's being mismanaged. And again, this is not something that I've even said, but that's exactly what's been happening. And there are many people on the front line, nurses and doctors, that have come out and said that. So that's different than talking about a protocol for COVID-19. If it was a person that had COVID-19, you know, intubation, for anybody that has a virus or any kind of a flu-like injury or infectious process like flu or any kind of a viral process going on, intubation is not the answer for that. I mean, that's a mechanical invasive method of stabilizing the airway, and a virus doesn't attack the airway. A virus attacks the lungs, which yes, that is part of the airway, but I'm talking about a tube down the throat is stabilizing the trachea at the point where the air is taken in from the mouth and through the trachea. The intubation does not affect the actual lungs. It just allows for air to go back and forth. So now if they're intubating a person, that means that their trachea is being compromised. And I'm not familiar with any virus that compromises the trachea. A virus compromises whatever tissue that it's going to attack. In this case, if it is a bronchitis or a pneumonia, you know, viral pneumonia or something like that, then it's affecting the lungs. But passing a tube down the throat is to maintain the airway. It is not to prevent. I mean, no, there's no such thing as a mechanical, invasive method of maintaining the airway for an infectious process, unless it was something that was targeting, let's say, the trachea. But there's nothing that I know of that targets a specific organ system like that. So coming back again, full circle, mismanagement of people that are sick is mismanagement of people that are sick. You can't say the person's being mismanaged because they weren't appropriately being treated for their medical condition and then call that a protocol. Does that make sense? Am I losing you, or does that make sense?
No, I think you found me. You know, we've seen many people have seen the viral video of the emergency room physician in New York who is saying what you're doing, what we are being told to do is not working, that these people aren't really having problems with their breathing. They're having problems with oxygen, with lack of oxygen in their blood. And it took a while for that to take hold. You know, it was pulled down. The video was pulled down, and then finally more and more physicians are coming to realize that this is not a condition that primarily impacts the lungs initially, that there's something else going on. And yet it took quite a while for the official protocol to be modified. And what we're finding, and one of the reasons I have you on the phone, and one of the reasons for my concern, is that very early on, anything out there that did not conform to the official narrative of what was causing this condition and how it was going to be treated was immediately censored. And so people, I don't think, have had access to all the full information. And, you know, there seems to be a lot of differences about that. If you had somebody come into your clinic, for example, into your practice, who seemed to be exhibiting symptoms of this condition, what would you do? What would your approach be as a frontline physicians?
Well, it's exactly the same it would be for any person with any kind of viral component. And it would be no different. And I mean, it's nobody has ever worn a face mask in my clinic. Nobody's, you know, worried about it because, you know, we have patients from all over the world that come with, that are really immunocompromised, cancer patients and such, HIV patients, and they're not concerned about it because that's what we deal with, and we have been for over a quarter of a century. And so, you know, there's no sudden virus that's come out here that's so dangerous and debilitating that's going to wipe out the human race. If it was, we would have been wiped out thousands of years ago, you know, hundreds of thousands. We wouldn't be able to survive. So this is there a COVID-19? Yes, there is. Is the COVID-19 what they've made it out to be? Absolutely, categorically not. Is COVID-19 something that people should be afraid of? Yes. Why? Because of the pathogenicity, because of the viral component, because of how it can kill you? No. They need to be scared about it because it's being used as a way to take away everybody's fundamental rights. It's being used for, I've already said this millions of times. If I've said it once, I mean, it feels like I've said it a million times. I don't know how many times I've said it, but I'll go anywhere in the world, wherever there's COVID-19, I'm not worried about it because it's something that can be prevented in the vast majority of cases, and the ones that it can't be prevented in, it's a self-limiting issue. People don't die from COVID-19. They die with COVID-19. And all these studies that have come out from Stanford and from everywhere, it clearly shows, yes, diagnosis is going up and up and up. Death rate is still the same. It has not changed. And so if you really look at the numbers, it starts to show how insignificant it really is. Every one of these studies is coming out that shows more people being diagnosed with it, more people having COVID-19, and the Centers for Disease Control now today, in fact, I think they just added on more symptoms. Now if you have diarrhea, you have congestion, you know, that they're concerned this COVID-19. But what about the people that are dying and that are being put down as COVID-19? Then what about those people, Dr. Tarr? You mean like people that died of a heart attack and that are being put down for COVID-19? Like my chief operating officer just told me that one of his neighbors died and they put him down as COVID-19, but he had a heart attack. Or my friend Sam, who lives in Atlanta, his neighbor's son committed suicide at 17, and they put down his cause of death as COVID-19. Are you talking about those type of you know, people that are dying from COVID-19?
How did that happen? How could they possibly take? I mean, I could understand somebody who's compromised with other lung issues, or already in the hospital, who were compromised already. But somebody who commits suicide. How do they figure that that's COVID-19? How could they possibly make that stretch?
Is that a rhetorical question? Or, I mean, I don't understand. I mean,
well,
it is
a rhetorical question. It's a rhetorical question.
Okay, because I don't know how they can do that. I mean, you're asking me something that's it's absurdity. It's lies. It's deception. That's one reason that, to me, it's like people need to wake up and start to realize. And people are waking up. I mean, they've just today, this morning on Newsweek, I read an article. They were saying the anti-vaxxers have, you know, they're so well organized and so well funded, and they're preventing there's already talk about refusing en masse the vaccine. And in Germany, like 50% or 60% of people have already said that they're not going to take it. And the United States, and they make this out to be, and the anti-vaxxers have this massive movement. No, it's people are awake. They are aware. They understand the basic logical premises in science. They understand cause and effect, and they are not buying this garbage, hook, line, and sinker as it's being fed. If you look at the media has lied categorically about this entire facade. Nobody talks about CBS and their sham hospital that they set up and had actors acting in there and telling some of the medical staff that, you know, that they did, the real medical staff, that you have to pretend like these people are patients. And then afterwards, where the interview, they didn't realize the camera was rolling, and one of the nurses says, well, you know, what made it complicated was we actually had two people that actually were real people, patients. The rest of them were all actors, so it kind of made it confusing trying to separate the real people from the fake. And of course, you know, it was only on social media. Mainstream media didn't cover it. Or how about ABC News that showed a hospital with all the critical care COVID patients in there in Italy, and then they talked about the hospital in New York that had all these critical care patients that were dying from COVID. And, oh, wait a second, it's the exact same footage from the same hospital. You know, and it didn't even look like, I mean, I've been in a lot of ICUs. I've never seen an ICU that looks like that. It looked like a long room with these open bay beds, but I've never seen an ICU that looks like that. And I thought, well, maybe in Italy it's like that. I don't know. I've never been to a hospital in Italy. And then they show the same thing in New York, and you realize it's all fabricated. Where are, in this day and age of social media, with people have social media and people have cameras everywhere, where is the footage of these people that are dying from COVID-19? And I'm telling you right now, I can produce, and I have in my Instagram and our YouTube, which has gotten censored left, right, and center, we've got numerous text messages, videos, emails from people saying, doctors and nurses saying, and other lay people saying that, you know, I went to work, three people died on my shift, I signed the death certificates, I come back into my shift next day, and the death certificates have been altered. Or family members saying, shame on you, to the San Antonio news station that I can't remember, WBOT, I think it was, where they claimed that the first case of COVID-19 that took place that died in San Antonio was at Brooke Army Medical Center, which is where I did a lot of my training. And then the family comes out and they say, that's such a lie. How can you say that? My grandmother did not die from COVID-19. She was a longtime hospice patient for Alzheimer's, and she had been fighting a case of aspiration pneumonia for the last few months, and she succumbed to that. And how can you say that she died of COVID-19? She wasn't even in BAMC. She was in a long-term healthcare facility. So all these false narratives that are being promoted as causes of COVID-19, they have to do that because it can't justify all these people that are suffering and dying from depression and suicide and hunger all over the world, and the millions of people that have died from this COVID-19 component, nothing to do with the virus, but from the shutting down of the economies of the world. And nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking about child sexual abuse and domestic sexual abuse and domestic violence and all these suicide components. How about all the people that have died from medical conditions that could be rectified in the hospital, but didn't go to the hospital because they were afraid of COVID-19, or they didn't go to the hospital because they were afraid of taxing an already overtaxed hospital system, whereas in fact, most hospitals are completely empty. The doctors are being furloughed. The nurses are being sent home. People aren't being allowed to work. And if you talk to doctors everywhere, they're saying the same thing. The vast majority of doctors, they're kind of scared because they don't want to say much because they don't want to have ramifications from regulatory agencies. But that's exactly what they're saying. Look at the senator, the physician who's a senator from the state of, Minnesota, who basically talked out about this, about the altered death certificates. And now the medical board is trying to investigate him. I've got three letters that I've got to respond to from complaints that came in because of me speaking out against the lies and trying to promote the truth and the facts as they are, as anybody can see them. But no, that's not important. That's not what they want to. That's not the narrative they want to push.
Let's take a quick break because we have to do that, to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this and vaccinations, et cetera, et cetera. We're talking with Dr. Rashid Buttar, and we're talking on Wiki Politiki Radio. Back in a few.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, Steve Berman back with WikiPolitiki. Well, you heard about the Ad Council. Something I wanted to add before we get back, Dr. Vitar. You know, several months ago, after all of those videos were shown, news items were shown with overcrowded ERs and all of that, there were some individuals, I think it was in Brooklyn, New York, my old hometown, who actually went the next day to these hospitals and everything was deserted. There were no lines, there were no people. And it's almost like we're living in this alternative reality. People are living in alternative realities. And I think something, because of so much pressure to conform to a certain way of thinking, it's very difficult for people to step out with their own point of view. And I know that you've had questions about vaccinations for years. Let's talk about that for a minute. Going back to your own personal family experience with vaccinations and what it was that caused you to see the problems with vaccinations and being dubbed an anti-vaxxer and so on. How did that come about?
Well, basically, my son was vaccine injured, and as they say, desperation is the mother of all innovation, and that's basically how the shift occurred for me. And with the grace of God, my son is remarkable. He's 21, getting ready to graduate from college next year, magna cum laude, and he's assuming that he keeps his grade point average up the way it is right now. He's a world-ranked martial artist. He's extraordinary from his money management skills that he's learned while playing poker, and has become a world-ranked person on one of the poker apps, and hopefully will be competing at one of the world championships. I mean, he's done extraordinarily well for anybody, but he was vaccine injured and he had lost his ability to speak and is still to this day the youngest formal witness before the U.S. Congress. He testified before the U.S. Congressional Subcommittee on Human Rights and Wellness back in May 6, 2004, and it was all to do with the additives and the preservatives and the constituents used in vaccines, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. Then you start looking at how the vaccines are administered, when they're administered, at what point in the development of a child that they're administered, at points when the child can't even seroconvert. There's no ability of the body to convert or to create an immune response, and yet we're giving vaccines at that time. And then when you start looking at the research and the data, which at that time I wasn't even aware of it, you start seeing how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children have been injured worldwide. You look at the statistics from the Centers for Disease Control themselves. They estimate that 1% of the world's population right now has autism. That's 1% of 7.7 billion people, or 77 million people in the world right now have autism. That's 77 million children and young adults that are suffering from autism. Yet in 1991, when the National Vaccine Initiative was launched, in 1991, the incidence of autism was only 1 in 10,000 people. Today, it's 1 in 30 people. So people will say that this is a genetic condition. Well, I have bad news for them. There is no such thing as a genetic epidemic. They talk about it to being an epidemic issue, and then they talk about it being a genetic issue. You don't have a genetic epidemic. First of all, there is no such thing. And plus, you don't have a genetic evolutionary process that takes place over a 29-year period where you have an incidence of 1 in 10,000 going to 1 in 30. That doesn't happen. There's something else that's coming into play here. And that something else is the amount of damaging substances that are in these vaccines. So specifically looking at mercury, which is what my forte has been, what I've looked at, but there's many other components. And mercury is the second most toxic substance known to man. Well, why do you have the second most toxic substance known to man in our dental amalgams that are outgassing at 5 to 9 nanograms per deciliter per tooth per day? Or why do we have mercury with an ethyl group added to it to make it thimerosal or ethyl mercury, making it 1,000 times more assimilable and damaging than it is in its natural inorganic form, which, by the way, in its natural inorganic form, according to the EPA, it's the second most toxic substance known to man, yet we are injecting that into newborn babies on the first day of the planet when their bodies can't even eliminate this naturally. So, I mean, you've got all these problems that have been occurring for decades, and now they've just upped the ante. Before it was our, you know, just a certain segment of kids. Now they've just upped it, and they're trying to affect the entire world's population. And, you know, the only thing that we have to make sure that we are aware of is the danger is not what it's being painted out to be. The danger is what's coming down the pipeline, the mandatory vaccination, the erosion of our civil liberties, the mandate of all these components that are nothing more than psychological imprinting techniques to make us, desensitize us to whatever's going to come next. So there are all sorts of problems, all sorts of issues that we should be aware of which the COVID-19 component itself, the infectious component, is maybe in the top, it might make the top 25. I doubt it. I think it's even lower than that.
Can I ask you a question? You obviously developed some kind of protocols in order to get your son from the regression that he was going through after this vaccination. I've seen the video. I've seen videos of him, you know, when he shortly after the vaccination, and then videos of him competing in martial arts events, and, you know, extraordinarily modest individual and yet very accomplished. What kind of protocols did you use to get him from where he was to where he is now?
Well, it probably would be an impossibility, even if I were to try to go through and explain that on a radio show. But the protocols have been developed to help facilitate the removal of mercury out of the body. And those were, in their rudimentary form, what I established with my son and two other children that were in the same type of situation that he was in. And they evolved over the last 21 years. Actually, this was all happening. We've been doing this for, I've been a physician for 29 years, but this type of medicine for 25 years. And as far as addressing children with autism since 1998, the year before my son was even born. And I actually had made a decision to stop seeing autistic kids before my son was born. I think my son came into my life as a message from the Creator that I was not here to do what I wanted to do. I was here to do something, that my mission was something different, and that it wasn't my choice, let's put it that way. So my son was almost like upping the ante for me to push me in the right direction. And that's exactly what he did. And he has taught me a tremendous amount, what I learned helping him to recover. And, you know, all credit goes back to the Creator, to the source that where we all came from, that we will all go back to. But the protocols are designed around the entire concept of effective detoxification from heavy metals, specifically mercury, and that's what the focus is on, but basically anything that shouldn't be in the body, and helping the body to recover and reestablish the natural balance with which it was designed to function.
So in part, this heavy metal detox, particularly mercury, was something that, were you able to see immediate results with your son? I mean, with mercury detox, is that what you did initially?
Well, I mean, again, there's videos and DVDs on this to help to explain the phenomena of non-excretors. So non-excretors can't excrete on their own, and so sometimes it takes multiple tests before you can actually establish that. That's the whole problem, that the tests don't show it. In fact, if you have somebody with some type of pathology and they don't show any metals, that's the worst type of situation, because that explains why they're non-excreted. They can't get rid of whatever is in their system. And so in the case of children that are suffering from developmental delays, that's exactly what you see. And you don't see an immediate result. You may see an immediate improvement or a relatively quick improvement in the clinical presentation, but you're not going to see the medical aspect as far as tests that are being established. You're not going to necessarily see that right off the bat. And so some of these kids, you know, they're treated for a long time. It can take a year, 2 years, 3 years. My son responded to treatment within 5 months of us initiating the treatment. We could see changes occurring within probably the first 4 months, 3 months, but he was beginning to speak. It was 5 months from the time that I saw the first, from the time I started treating him to the first time that he was able to speak with words and put them together like he had prior to his vaccine injury. So, I mean, he didn't have a very big vocabulary when he was injured. I mean, he may have had 10, 15 words. At the age of a year and a half, he's lost every word that he was saying, he lost. And at three, on his third birthday, is when I was able to establish, after four tests, I was able to establish that he did have a mercury issue, and he had a couple of other metals. And within 5 months, he was talking again. So, but it varies. Everybody varies. The fastest we've had is a child within 3 weeks. Went from no speech at all, never having spoken, to 500-word vocabulary in 3 weeks. And we've had other, and that wasn't even a child that I treated. That was a doctor. That was a child that was treated by another doctor who was using our protocol. And we've had other children that have taken, you know, 4 or 5 years.
You know, this is the thing that I find so vexing, is that because of the marginalization of alternatives, and I know that you've had, you know, issues with the North Carolina medical examiners and so on. If you go to Wikipedia, all of these alternatives, which of course I've used over the years with great for great benefit, are slandered as quackery and so on. And this has been going on perhaps since Abraham Flexner in the origination of the American Medical Association. So it seems like there really is a battle of narratives going on, and I'm just, you know, and I'm concerned, you know, even though I try to be agnostic about a lot of these things, because again, there's certain things that mainstream medicine does very well, but in dealing with chronic issues, it seems to really be where that old saying, it's the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so the drug-based medical system continues to manage symptoms rather than really cure anything. So I'm just wondering how you see a future unfolding where we can actually create a narrative that is based on truth, rather than based on people taking positions and not having all the information. How do we do this? We have a very, very polarized country right now. And I think most people in this country, and you probably would agree, most people don't want to be polarized. Most people would prefer to work together. There's a movement, I know you're part of the movement, to preserve medical choice and so on. It seems to be primarily centered with conservative libertarians, and yet I know that there's many people on the progressive side, if they had the information, they would go, I want to protect my health too. I don't want to be subject to, the pharmaceutical companies. How do we bring people together to find things out rather than accept the silo narrative that they've been given?
Well, I think that's a loaded question, and it's a question that has been entertained for a long time. I think that's what the problem is, the desire for a narrative, the desire for a dialogue, there's a desire for a discussion. And I think at a certain point, you have to now recognize that the one party here is not interested in a dialogue or discussion, because their agenda is not one that is conducive to a dialogue or to discussion or to exploration. Their agenda is far more nefarious. It's far more evil, if you want to call it that. And they're relying on the ignorance of the masses to be able to instill and propagate what their agenda is. And so you talked about the Flexner Report and going all the way back, you know, 100 years or however long ago it was, you start to see that there is a organized dissemination of this misinformation campaign. And, you know, you called it an alternative therapy. I don't believe that that's an appropriate term, because an alternative designates, if you are on the highway and the highway is blocked, there's an alternative route and you have to go down a dirt road and cross over a creek bed with gravel and then come up the other side and then, you know, knock off all the mud off your tires and then get back on the highway. That's the alternative route. This is not alternative. To me, this is advanced medicine. That's why we've called it advanced medicine for 25 years. I think that this should be the first and foremost route that's taken before other more invasive means are put in place. The father of surgery, Sabiston, the Sabiston's textbook of surgery, in the first chapter, Dr. Sabiston describes what he says is the ultimate admission of defeat. And again, this is the father of surgery defining the ultimate admission of defeat in medicine being surgery. So I was trained in surgery, and I know many good surgeons that actually will do other things before they resort to surgery, and that's what a good surgeon should do. A monkey can do the actual operation. I'm being somewhat facetious, but I mean, it obviously takes talent, the more talented the surgeon is, but it's the preoperative and the postoperative care and surgery that really makes that makes a surgeon what they are. And so there's a lot of things that can be taken care of non-surgically. And surgery is actually the least invasive. I know that sounds not intuitive when I say it's the most non-invasive. Surgery is a non-invasive or comparative. When you're looking at cancer, for example, you look at radiation, you look at chemotherapy, and then you look at surgery. Surgery of those three options is the least invasive. How can I say that it's the least invasive when you're cutting into the body? Because the surgery is limited to that area of the body that you're entering, as opposed to chemotherapy, which is affecting the entire immune system and the rest of the body as far as wherever the chemo gets you, but it's affecting the entire immune system. And radiation, similarly, is affecting the entire immune system and also affecting the certain parts of the body with ancillary damage around the primary area for that's being irradiated. So surgery, actually, comparatively speaking, is least invasive. And so that's what I mean, that there's certain things that should be done. And then if you need to resort to surgery, you resort to surgery. When it comes to acute trauma medicine, we are so far advanced, and we have made such amazing progress. And that's really where medicine shines. When it comes to the chronic diseases, the palliative nature of how we deal with heart disease and cancer, and we start seeing many of these diseases that have exploded over the last 20, 30 years, like autism, like Alzheimer's, some of these components, well, you start realizing that we have been pathetically inadequate in how medicine is being applied and how people are being treated. And I think that in the future, this will be remembered as one of the most barbaric times in the history of mankind because of what we do. We know that chemo is poisonous. That's why people wear hazmat suits when they're operating and creating chemo. We know that radiation is damaging. That's one reason when people break their legs or need a chest x-ray, we make them wear protective lead-lined attire to protect their certain organs, and also people that are allowing these people to get these treatments or getting these diagnostics done. Those people, like the radiation technologists and the radiologists, they're wearing protective gear. Why do we wear that protective gear? Because we know that it causes DNA adducts and causes mutation of cells that can then lead to cancer. Well, if we know that the radiation can lead to cancer, and that's why we protect people, and if we know that when making chemotherapy, we have to protect the people that are working with the chemotherapy with hazmat suits because that can cause cancer, then when somebody does get cancer, we give them the same thing that causes cancer? I mean, does that make any sense from a logical perspective? You know, Einstein said a long time ago, I was just going to say, let me just make a quote from Einstein. Einstein said that you cannot solve a problem with the same mindset that created it. And that's exactly the point here. The environmental report, the presidential report for cancer in 2010 It was a 240-some-page document, and it can be summarized in one sentence, and that is cancer is an environmental issue and has to be addressed. And until we address that environmental issue, we're not going to make a difference in this whole process. And this comes back to, you know, Dr. Lipton's work, where he talks about the signal. You know, this is the environment's response, or the genetic code's response to the environment is what we're dealing with here. So it's not just the environment of what we're drinking and what we're eating and what we're breathing in, but it's also the internal environment within our bodies, in the state of our nutrition, the state of our health, and it's also the state of our mindset, of our thoughts. These are all various signals, and they all cause the genetic expression that then allows for the manifestation of a specific type of protein. And for people that don't understand and say this is just metaphysical BS, well, there's only 20,000 genes in the human body, the same number of genes that are found in a worm, but yet there's 100,000 proteins that have been defined, and I'm sure there's other proteins that we haven't defined yet. So then if one gene decodes for one protein, then obviously that theory falls flat on its face, because we know that we have 5 times as many known proteins as we have genes. So then what causes a gene to express one protein versus another protein? And it's that signal. It's that environmental signal. And so when I first met Dr. Lipton, and in fact, that's one of the things that I asked the audience, I showed a couple of videos before and after, some cancer patients, some autism patients, and I asked people, you know, would you like to know what we did here? Because it was dramatic changes in these people's lives. It wasn't just one or two people, it was 4 people. And it was all conditions that were untreatable. And then you see the people before and after. And I asked the audience, would you like to know what I did? And everybody was like, yes, of course. And I said, that's all I did, what Dr. Lipton said. I changed the signal. I changed the signal. Mm-hmm. When you detoxify the body and remove toxins, you're changing the signal. When you improve the nutrition in an individual, you're changing the signal. When you change your mindset and your thought process, you're changing the signal. It's all about changing the signal.
And speaking about signals, we have to take a short break to do some commercial stuff. We'll be back right after. This is fascinating information. I wish we had 2 hours. Steve Behrman talking with Dr. Rashid Buttar about the medicine that shouldn't be alternative, that should be primary. Back after these messages.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Hey Well, there's we're back with our final segment with Dr. Bitar. A lot of grits for the mill here. I want to go back to something that you said, because I certainly agree with you that there is a battle going on between between natural medicine, that is the idea that the body heals itself, and medicine is simply is an aid to make that so. And these invasive means, you suggested surgery is the least invasive of these invasive means. And in all of the talk about health care and this and that and who should get it and who shouldn't get it, who pays for it, the one missing piece in that conversation is the contribution that our environment and environmental toxins and other stressors play in this in the wellness game. One of the projects I'm working on right now, and Bruce and I are working on something called Reset, using this this time as a way to reset our priorities as a humanity. So I'm curious as to how you would reset medicine. If you had your soapbox platform and the magic wand, how would you change the way medicine is practiced today so that we would actually be building health rather than just fighting disease?
Well, there's two components to this. And it's, a question that is a great question, but it's a loaded question. So there's a medical aspect of it, and there's a political aspect of it. And the political aspect is actually the first and foremost aspect, because Benjamin Rush, who was one of the founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence, he was the only physician who signed the Declaration of Independence. And he made a statement, there was a quote that he had, and I'm not going to be able to remember the exact quote, but the essence of it was that if one day, basically it was the importance of having medical freedom and equating it to religious freedom. And he said that if we don't have medical freedom in the Constitution, then one day medicine will become a dictatorship and will control the outcome. And you know, I'm going to see if I can find the exact quote, because it's frustrating when you can't remember a quote, and it's a very, very powerful quote. But essentially, he talked about the importance of placing emphasis on the equality between religious freedom and medical freedom. And this is something that's really important to remember, because if we understand how the current medical system is causing many of the problems, that it's not because of the medical system per se, it's actually because of the politicization of medicine. And that is a very, very dangerous place to be. I'll tell you that I personally believe that many of these issues could be rectified if we had a church, the difference between church and state, like the separation between church and state, we should have a separation between medicine and state. And it is actually something that would, in my opinion, rectify all issues. And when it comes to the actual medicine itself, well, you know, there's, when you start to understand physiology and understand how we are no longer understanding and recognizing and addressing how the body works. We're not looking at the physiological principles. We are now a pharmacological model. And that, again, goes back to the first aspect of the politicization of medicine, because they are allowing by allowing the politicization of medicine, we are allowing that one individual or one entity, which is Big Pharma, to dictate how medicine is being practiced. And that's why everything is around using pharmacological interventions and not looking at other non-pharmacological interventions. We forget that the study of the human body, how the body works, is a study of physiology, is the science of physiology, and we virtually don't spend any time understanding physiology. And many of these drugs that we are creating, they basically go against how the body was designed to work. You know, we have beta blockers, we have calcium channel blockers, we have all these blockers or inhibitors, and the body doesn't work that way. You inhibit a reaction, you block stuff, you cause stagnation. We should be looking at things that are enhancing our metabolism, enhancing our body, not blocking X and Y and Z. And that's my philosophy. But regardless, if you were looking at how the body works, that would be an inevitable conclusion that everybody would come to, because they can see how the body works. We don't work based upon things being blocked. We work on based upon things, how the body flows, how reactions take place. Our bodies have, you know, our cells in our bodies have 100 million reactions. I'm sorry, 100,000 reactions per second per cell. So if you have 100,000 reactions taking place per second per cell, then just imagine how many reactions are taking place. And when you start taking a drug that inhibits or blocks or prevents some reaction from taking place, you know, what kind of a cascade are you creating? It's a massive, massive problem.
Yes. So we definitely have a medical system that is, and also if you think about over the past 20 or so years, drug companies can now advertise on the media. And so now we have a media that is cash dependent on not offending the drug companies. And so we have this this airtight system that doesn't really want to allow any dissonant opinions, even if those dissonant opinions are actually more medically accurate than the drug-based position. So how do we deal with this? You mentioned the political aspect of it, but what would medicine look like, assuming that the megaphone was big enough to reach enough critical mass of the uncritical masses, so that people were clamoring for a system that was, in harmony with nature? What would medicine look like now?
Well, you just hit it when you said about the media. So the media are the lapdogs of big pharma. They're controlled by the hierarchy for these people that we're talking about that have whatever nefarious agenda that they have. You know, I think population control has to be looked at, because that's what publicly has been stated by some of the people that are the most outspoken people about this current COVID-19, people like Bill Gates, who they're eugenists. They're openly eugenists, and they've talked about the mandate that the world can only sustain 500 million population, and we are at right now 7.7 billion population. So we're basically 15 times what, you know, Bill Gates and his eugenics platform believe is possible. This is stuff that's gone on for 20, 30 years. People have talked about this. But, you know, it comes back to that quote by Benjamin Rush: unless we put medical freedom into the Constitution, the time will come when medicine will organize into an undercover dictatorship. To restrict the art of healing to one class of men and deny equal privileges to others will constitute the Bastille of medical science. All such laws are un-American and despotic. So that's what Benjamin Rush had said. And this is one of the issues that that's why I talked about the politicization of it, and then of course the mainstream media and their propagation of the false narrative. And it's important to remember that he who dictates history, or he who controls the narrative, I should say, he who controls the narrative dictates history. So what would medicine look like if you could hit the critical masses? It would look like this. It would look like where people are allowed the freedom to see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear, and not be suppressed, not having things like, by saying that water will cure your dehydration, that's now creating a drug claim in water, and now you have to have a legal precedence to define what claims can be made for water. Well, that's taking it to an extreme example, but that's an exact example that the FDA gave me when they inspected our lab. So it would really come down to openness and fairness, and where you are no longer allowed to, the United States and New Zealand, the only two countries that allow for advertisement of drugs in the media, where you can openly advertise drugs. No other country allows that. And I was shocked to hear that only the United States and New Zealand do that. But coming down to what would it would look like, it would look like people having the freedom to choose what they want to choose, being able to dictate the types of foods and types of substances are taken to the body is not being mandated to take these things. That's what freedom would look like, and that's what true healthcare would look like. And there are enough people right now in this nation and many other nations that absolutely would not tolerate being told what to take in their bodies. Thomas Jefferson said, when a people allow a government to dictate the foods they put in their mouths and the medicines they take into their bodies, their souls will soon be in the same sorry state as those who live under tyranny. And that really is how I can summarize it the best.
Wow, what a conversation. Thank you, Dr. Bitar, for stimulating our thought processes and our feeling processes. I'm sure that we can have a lot more to say about this. I want to thank you so much for being with us on WikiPolitiki today. And I'm definitely, I'm expecting a lot of feedback on this show, and I look forward to another conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.